There is no free lunch when it comes to investing, but what about a podcast that delivers educational content on investing, financial planning, items of interest, and even the odd wacky topic? Welcome to The Free Lunch, hosted by Canvas Wealth. Free Lunch will bring listeners the team's vast knowledge and experience in dealing with uncertainty. Learn more and subscribe today at canvaswealth.ca.
Welcome back to the Free Lunch Podcast again with Greg and Colin.
Has it been a week already?
It's actually amazing. Only been a few minutes. We're recording back-to-back episodes. But the reason we're doing that is we were having such a good conversation about the changes in reflecting the change on the changes over the last 30 years since you started in the business that we thought we would just carry on with this conversation.
It's more than a 30-minute conversation, as it turns out.
Yeah, well, I guess you could have like one decade per 30 minutes.
Yeah, so we need a third episode? Maybe not.
We'll see. I think we're going to get through it. But
because when you think about it, it's not just like a little bit has happened, like a lot has happened. And, you know, I guess over a period of 30 years, you expect a lot to happen. But there are probably professions where not a lot has happened over 30 years. You know, I think of the legal profession. You know, I mean, so, you know, people that I know that are lawyers or were lawyers, you know, they kind of behaved the same way back then that they do now. Maybe a little bit easier to get access to, you know, case law and stuff using the internet than using the internet, you know, rather than having to go through and, you know, read through, you know, these massive libraries that each law office used to have.
You remember like pictures of, did you ever watch LA Law?
Sure.
You know, they'd be in their offices and they'd have like just bookshelves full of legal bound cases.
Yeah. We don't need that anymore. No, available at the push of a button. But no, there's been a lot of changes. And when you, and the very things that we've been talking about, you know, changes in the compensation structure, changes in the nature of the products, changes in, you know, the overall service model. Like what role does the advisor play in the investor's life? You know?
Well, don't jump ahead because I've got a question for you.
Okay.
And it goes right into that.
All right.
So in your opinion, your humble opinion.
Humble.
How did the advisor's role change with the transition from stock brokers to full service wealth managers and possibly fiduciaries?
Yeah. So for me, and I guess for anybody that started around the time I did, it was an evolution because certain of the changes were forced on us by regulation and other changes were embraced by us because they just made sense. Well, you know, when I was first starting in the business, my job was to make stock or mutual fund recommendations that we thought would do well and ideally do better than the market, because what we used to say, well, who just wants to do as well as the market? What's the point? But over time, you know, we became more true advisors, you know, so, you know, starting as a stock broker, which just means your job is to buy and sell stocks for someone, acting as the intermediary, taking a commission and doing what the client wants you to do.
Which is really just about having access.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. You know, and because, you know, we weren't fiduciaries, we were just advisor brokers. You know, our job was really to make a recommendation, probably based on the research that was provided to us. The client, you know, said yes or no, and then you go ahead and do it, and then move on to the next client or the next product. And, you know, and if you think of, okay, well, what's the end point? Well, the end point now is, as we talked about, you know, getting to know the client, you know, at a very deep and personal level, understanding, you know, what their goals are, but not only understanding their goals, because some people have goals that are maybe not realistic, understanding how investments and planning can help the client achieve those goals and when changes need to be made, you know, to sort of take on that role. And that was a very gradual thing, you know, so, and partly driven by product, as it turns out, because over time, let's say groups of mutual funds or investments like that, they were morphed into individual investments managed like mutual funds. So segregated investments. So clients would end up with what looked to be like a mutual fund. They were like separately managed accounts, we called them. Looked like a mutual fund because they might hold 150 stocks, but the stocks were held segregated for them. And so rather than owning units of a mutual fund, they would own all these stocks. But the stocks themselves would be managed by a separately by a manager. Mm-hmm. And so the clients would end up getting a more diverse portfolio. But, you know, and it sort of addressed both sides. Well, I like to see the individual stocks in my account, but I want a well-balanced portfolio. Mm-hmm. What they did is that, well, all of a sudden the stockbroker now, well, what is your role as a stockbroker when the investments are actually being managed by an outside manager? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm either going to, you know, just not talk to the client anymore, or I'm going to spend time when I'm meeting with the client to review investments, what's going on in the world, markets, things like that. What value can I add? Because otherwise, you're really not adding a lot of value. It's the mm-hmm. investment manager that's doing it. So it was a combination of things. Focus on trying to add more value to a client. And that's really just, what's marketing all about? Marketing is just kind of trying to understand clients' needs and then
Meeting those
needs better than somebody else, right? Yeah.
But SMAs to me is just marketing, right?
It is marketing, because why would somebody need to own 4 shares of an individual stock rather than just units of a mutual fund?
Yeah.
Well, you feel good because you maybe address some behavioral biases or cognitive biases by being able to look at all these individual stocks. Oh, I've got shares of, I've got shares of Apple too.
Yeah.
Because I've got 4 of them in the portfolio. But it is marketing. It doesn't really address the need. Mm-hmm. The need is, a well-diversified portfolio, because it creates more challenge. Okay, it makes tax reporting more difficult. It's an interesting idea, but mm-hmm. an unnecessary idea.
Let me tell you about a little evolution that we're going through here now. Because we're licensed as institutional portfolio managers now, not mm-hmm. retail, mm-hmm. we're actually launching our first signature pool.
Okay.
Very shortly.
Yep.
It's going to be a fixed income pool.
Mm-hmm.
And within the pool will be our fixed income strategy.
Yes.
The way forward now is to create a fixed income pool of the same products.
Yes.
Get better pricing, but then it reports on the statements as one line item.
Yeah.
So it'd be like, it's not going to be called this, but let's say it's called Canvas Wealth Fixed Income,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that goes totally against the SMA marketing.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
Because we're going to be reporting things as one line item, and somebody that had an SMA wanted an SMA because they wanted 50 line items.
Well, that's right. And part of the education sort of evolved as we as advisors evolved was this concept that, okay, well, everything in my portfolio has to do well all at the same time. Mm-hmm. Right. Because that never happens, and someone said, you're properly diversified when there's always something in the portfolio to complain about.
Yeah.
And so what happens is, when you give too much information or information that's not helpful in making decisions, it's like, okay, well, I've got my 125 stocks here. This one's doing well, so let's keep that one. But this one isn't doing so well, so let's get rid of that one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing, whether it's an individual stock or looking at mutual funds and how they're doing. You have to look at portfolios. And it's why this, part of the evolution we talked about was stop looking at the individual security, whether it's a stock or a fund. Look at how is the portfolio performing, mm-hmm. understanding that diversification means that, if stocks are doing extremely well, bonds may not be doing as well, and vice versa. And so taking the focus off the individual investments, having an understanding of how the investments are structured and making sure that you're properly diversified and allocated the way it's appropriate, and then not worrying about it as far as the individual securities, but worrying about, am I on track?
Yeah.
I've got a plan. Am I on track?
Yeah.
And understanding why portfolios behave in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So that again is also part of the evolution, is taking the focus off the individual security, again, whether it's a stock or a fund, and focusing more on the portfolio as a whole.
So I remember back when I started at a bank, I was working in a bank branch mm-hmm. as a banker, and we did not have email. It was before corporate emails were released.
Yeah.
And I'd have people say to me, can you just email that to me? And I'd say, well, I'll have to go home and send it from my Hotmail account.
Yes.
Sure. So in your experience, you obviously operated in a similar time frame.
Yep.
There's been a lot of advancements in pre-internet, early internet, and just tech-driven environments now. What was your experience like?
You know, I mean, I came in at a good time. The internet, obviously, the ability to surf the internet to get information was not well developed.
Well, you called it the internet earlier, though.
And the internet. Well, that was different. That was the precursor to the internet. But what we did have, so we had an early version of the internet, but it was...
Lycos?
It was an internal internet. It was called an intranet,
right?
Where we could get easy access to our own, you know, information. So at the firm I worked at, you know, we could get access to the research reports and that kind of thing within our own intranet. Mm-hmm. But email was not, you know, particularly popular yet. Mm-hmm. And so in a good way, I think maybe we relied on phone. Maybe it's less convenient for investors or clients who maybe didn't have time to, you know, to spend on the phone. But it was certainly a good way to ensure personal contact. Mm-hmm. And so that was one good thing looking back, you know. So it's easy to look back, you know, pre-progress to the olden days and say, okay, but there were some good things about it. Certainly the, you know, the build out of the internet and the ability to use search engines to get information and get access to quick information or information that was mm-hmm. not just proprietary to the company you were working for, but other sources of information made a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And it also made a huge difference for clients, you know, because when I started in the business, it was just the very early days of discount brokerage, mm-hmm. where investors were able to go open up their own discount brokerage account, not use an advisor, just to open up their own account and trade stocks for a much lower cost.
And how did that go for most people that are now have access to trading with no experience?
It didn't go well, you know, and part of it was, you know, it came at a very interesting time because it came at the time when the technology stocks on the NASDAQ were skyrocketing, you know, so the 4-year lead up to the tech bubble bursting, you know, technology stocks and NASDAQ stocks really appreciate by massive amounts. And so, of course, anybody investing on their own wanted to get in on that action. Mm-hmm. And we know it ended badly. And, you know, and so, you know, there's that expression, don't mistake a bull market for brains. You know, it just means that, you know, there's various expressions, rising tide lifts all boats, mm-hmm. things like that. You know, when the markets are on a roll, you know, they take on a life of their own. Or they can take on a life of their own, and if you catch the wave, you can ride it for a while, but eventually, you know, crashes into shore. And
well, I have a saying, you might have heard this one, I'm sure you have, bulls make money, bears make money, and pigs get slaughtered.
That's right.
Yeah, that's another one. I just wanted to throw my own in there.
Cause yeah, I think my grandmother used to tell me that, because in the 1950s, you know, my grandmother, of all people, you know, was trading stocks on the BC Stock Exchange.
Why not?
Exactly. And I didn't inherit a lot of wealth, so I guess it didn't work out maybe so well for her. So,
yeah.
But anyway, but certainly I think the, you know, the development of the internet has made life easier for many people, although more complex, because the massive amount of information that's out there means you have to sift through it. You have to separate real information from fake information.
Mm-hmm.
And
especially now.
That's right.
With all the fake news and what is news, what is research?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah, so with progress there, you know, there certainly are some downsides. And then you know, and then of course now, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is the, you know, artificial intelligence and and what that can mean for investors.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. You know, we have these things called CRM tools, so just client relationship management tools. Just a place to make notes and, mm-hmm. and things like that. Portfolio management software, data aggregation services.
Yep.
I mean, that obviously has changed a lot over the last 30 years.
For sure, yeah.
What was the CRM tool like back when you started?
I started, the CRM tool was a pen and a pad of paper.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if you were really diligent, you would, you know, you would have a file, you know, a physical file for all of your clients, and you could, you know, maybe make notes and keep those notes in. But the reality was, you know, it was because it was such a transactional, you know, a business back then, you know, you'd pick up the phone, you'd call them, hi, how are things? And I've got an idea for you.
Yeah.
And so the, you know, so the client relationship management tools and processes that, you know, that we developed over the years and then supported by technology, the tools themselves. What a great way to, first of all, ensure that, you know, your knowledge base, you know, with regards to your clients is up to date, that what the investments you're making are fully reflective of everything you know about that client. It makes for a better client experience, first of all. It makes for a better advisor experience because you go into a meeting knowing what you need to know about the client, and you just get, you develop a deeper understanding between you and the client, and it allows you to develop a, you know, a trust relationship that you probably couldn't. We, you know, people trusted us in the old days, you know, I think because maybe they liked us, you know, we were personable anyway, or tried to be, but they wouldn't entrust us with the kind of information that we needed to do our jobs properly, the way we define that today. Because we didn't have those tools. We only had a telephone, a pen, and a paper. And
that's not true. Yeah. You had another tool.
What was that?
You had a Rolodex.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
So Rolodex. Imagine all the space on your desk that's been saved now from not having a Rolodex.
That's true. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. How has the demographic of both clients and advisors shifted over the last three or so decades?
Interesting question because you're a smart guy, so you ask interesting questions, I guess. I always loved doing podcasts, and when you'd, you know, we'd be talking to, let's say, a guest to come on our show, and we'd say, well, you know, what kind of, how do you want us to lead you? You know, what are some questions you want us to ask? And he'd send us the question. He's asking the question. They'd say, that's a great question.
Yeah. I'm glad you asked that. That's a really great question. Well, in all full transparency, you did not know this question was coming.
Exactly. What was the question again? I've totally forgotten.
How has the demographic of both clients and advisors shifted?
It's interesting because when I started, so in my training class, I think there was about 30, 31 of us or so. And I was the second oldest. I was 42 years old when I started in the business. And there was one other woman that was on the course, two other women, that were around my age or maybe even a few years older. And pretty much the rest of the crowd were 23, 24, 25. So these are young people starting out in their careers and had no, you know, background in working at a bank or in a financial institution, but you know, maybe it worked at a bank and, you know, in a summer, you know, kind of position. So demographically, the people entering the business, very young. We all went out, you know, on our own after we finished training and we started pounding the pavement essentially because, you know, you can't give investment advice if you don't have any clients or you can't give stock pick advice, you know, and so generally speaking, we would find that the kind of people that we would deal with were our own friends, you know, because who else are you going to call? You know, you can go through lists of doctors or dentists, you know, very common way of prospecting in those days.
Yeah.
You know, you got to start somewhere. So I would say, though, that as time progressed, first of all, to get into this business as 24-year-old with no real contacts and just and a real interest in being in the investment business, almost impossible. I won't say it is impossible. There's lots of, you know, people that are real self-starters.
Yeah.
But I think to become an advisor these days, you work into it by starting with working on a team, an advisory team, and learning the ropes and, you know, and working either as an assistant or as an associate investment advisor and building your knowledge base and your ability to deal with clients by working on a team, but not as an investment advisor and certainly not as a portfolio manager.
Well, you can't just start as a portfolio manager. You got to have so many years of experience and et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I think the demographics as well is of the investor base is that I would say that it's broadened out. You know, because, you know, very often if you're an advisor when you're starting out, well, who are your best clients? The ones with money. But that's not true. You know, and when I look at some of, you know, my deepest, longest relationships with people that amassed a large amount of wealth, they didn't have a large amount of wealth when I started with them.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think what's happened is maybe an understanding that it's not how much wealth you have when the relationship begins that drives, you know, whether you're going to have a good relationship or the nature of the relationship or just, you know, that the demographics are more function of, well, you know, what is your saving plan? You know, you can't invest if you don't have savings. Do you have a plan for savings? And so I think now the demographics of the investor base is actually, I would say, a lot broader than it used to be. Younger people with good jobs are fantastic, people to start with because they can develop the right strategy and the right approach right off the bat. They don't have to mm-hmm. learn the hard lessons that, you know, we maybe learned when we were younger.
Yeah.
So I don't know. What are you finding? Because
this isn't about me, Greg. This is about you.
Yeah, but it was the same thing. You know, mm-hmm. it's like you used to think, okay, well, you know, you don't want to deal with, 35-year-olds because they don't have much money and they're maybe starting families and they won't have money to invest for, until their kids leave the house. So you want to focus mm-hmm. on 55-year-olds, who are maybe empty nesters now and are in their strongest savings years.
Right.
Not necessarily true, and we know from the power of compounding that if you can get people starting in their 20s, mm-hmm. or when they have their first job that allows them any excess cash, they can become not only your best clients, but some of the most successful investors.
I think that the change that I've noticed is, so I started when I was 30. Mm-hmm. And it was all about, like you say, you're managing money for wealthy people. And people would often say, well, what's your minimum?
Yep.
How much do I have to invest with you? And you'd come up with some number, right? So now, as I've been doing this job for well over 20 years, people will say, well, what's your minimum? And I say, my minimum is that you're a good person.
Yep.
And that you value the advice that we're going to provide to you.
Sure.
That's my minimum.
Yeah.
Right? And I met with somebody recently, CEO of a big company worth a lot of money. And I could tell in the conversation that we had that this isn't going to work out. It's not a good fit. They have a lot of money, but we see things differently.
Yeah.
And now I've got the experience to know it's good to say this isn't going to work out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's how it's changed for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and as I say, there used to be a joke when I started in this business, like anybody with $5 in a pulse was your best client, mm-hmm. And that was, that's haha, but it's not right, but there was partly right. It's like anybody with some money, obviously $5 isn't the right number. Anybody with some money and a desire, to set goals and to work towards those, they could be a fantastic client.
Yeah.
And as I say, some of my best clients were not ones that didn't start out with lots of money.
Well, I think one of the most rewarding parts of this job is actually helping people solve problems.
Yeah.
Right. And so that person with $100 million really doesn't have a lot of financial problems to solve. Right.
No.
Yeah. So, okay, let's change gears here because we're going to run out of time again.
Yep.
What about regulatory changes you've noticed over the last 30 or so
years? Massive changes, and most good, but some difficult, from an advisor standpoint. So, again, things like deferred sales charges, one of the things that before I started, just a few years before I started in the business with mutual funds, you had the option of either deferred sales charge where you earned 5% and then a trailer fee of 0.5%, every year on those assets. Before I started, in the really olden days, you used to be able to charge a 9% upfront commission.
9%.
You never got got any further payment, along the way.
One time.
It was a one-time payment. But, if somebody gave $100,000, they really only got $91,000 worth of value.
Yeah.
And they had to hope that, against all hope, that their fund would do well enough that they could chew through that and actually make some money one day.
That's crazy.
Totally crazy. So when I started, we were in the middle of the first, and they called it CRM as well, didn't mm-hmm. they? But it was basically a regulatory push to try to reduce the amount of conflict of interest in advisors and providers of things like mutual funds. For example, prior to my joining, mutual fund companies could take some of their best supporters on trips to the Caribbean, trips to Florida, and kind of it's a bit reminiscent of maybe what goes on in the pharmaceutical industry with pharmaceutical companies entertaining doctors and mm-hmm. things like that. But clearly there was a conflict of interest there. Mm-hmm. And so the first round of these changes came back in the 90s where they got rid of those rules. So the days of being able to just fly someone down to the Bahamas, you know, for 4 or 5 days, those were over. But then the rules got stricter over time. As I mentioned, you know, in the early days, you know, a client didn't even have to sign the Know Your Client form. You could open an account over the phone and start investing. The rules became a lot stricter in terms of actually knowing your client, having your client agree to a set of risk, you know, factors for their portfolio, so they understood what risks, you know, and the kinds of investments that they were making would entail. And then, of course, and the regulatory environment just became stricter and stricter,
yeah,
you know, to a point, as you know, where now before you can even recommend a client to a product, you have to prove and have proof in your file that you understand that product. You understand what the risks of investing in that particular product are, and be able to disclose that information to the client and prove that that information was disclosed to the client. Mm-hmm. So there's a massive amount of administrative burden on advisors now to ensure that they not only understand their clients, but understand the products that they're recommending mm-hmm. to clients. It's a good thing in the end. I mean, of course, you know, you shouldn't be recommending investments to clients if you don't yourself understand them or understand what the risks are. But the benefit of that is that it allowed us to really focus on, well, we know there are certain products that we know extremely well and the ones that we would typically recommend to clients in our model portfolios and things like that. And then if a client called up and asked about a stock or a product that we were unfamiliar with, we would have to identify, look, I can't make a recommendation on that. I don't know it, and if you really want to, you know, buy that product, let's talk about it, because maybe there's alternatives that are better for you that I do understand and I'm familiar with.
Yeah.
So I think it's these regulations have made it tougher for advisors, but in the long run, better for advisors and definitely better for investors.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you're right. I mean, it only makes sense that we should know the products that we are positioning.
Yes.
And that's always driven me a bit crazy. Like even at previous firm we worked at, there was somebody sat down the hall who sold a lot of these structured notes to their clients.
Yep.
I think that's all they sold.
Yeah.
And I remember that person came to me one day and said, "How's a bond fund work?"
Mm-hmm.
I was like, "Wow." Like, how are you selling these other things and you don't have a general understanding of bonds and bond funds?
Yeah. And listen, it's not that those products aren't appropriate for some people. They might be perfectly appropriate. But if the advisor can't sort of explain how the product works, why it's structured the way it is, mm-hmm. what the risks are, you know, then it shouldn't be offered to a client.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, we're going to run out of time here, but I do want to ask two more questions.
All right.
So you're going to have to summarize your answers.
Okay.
Okay, the first one is, looking back to 1996, when you think about this industry, what don't you miss about it?
What don't I miss about what it was like in 1996?
Yeah.
I don't miss the pressure of feeling like, okay, I need to make transactions. You know, if I don't make transactions, you know, the kids aren't eating tonight.
Yeah.
You know, and so by operating on commission, and whether you're a stock broker or a car salesman or whatever, there's a lot of pressure, and it would be too easy to be pressured into doing the wrong thing
mm-hmm.
for the purpose of making a sale and earning a commission.
Yeah.
And so I don't miss that at all.
Yeah.
I was delighted to be finished with that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Okay. Now we've talked a lot about evolution in the space, both in the job, but also in technology. The biggest form of evolution we're going through right now is generative AI.
Yep.
And somebody said to me one day, your job's going to be replaced by AI.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I don't think so. I think my job is going to be better because of AI, because of my use of generative AI. Where do you see the next evolution coming? Is it from AI, fee compression, consolidation, or something else entirely?
Yeah, I mean, I might be the wrong person to ask that question, and being a baby boomer and not a Gen Xer like yourself, you know, my knowledge and use of the technology is more, you know, more limited. Mm-hmm. But I think, as I said earlier, some of these, you know, generative AI, I think, has the potential, you know, to make our jobs, you know, or your job easier or maybe not easier isn't the right word, maybe better by giving more options, more, you know, having a better understanding of maybe when you look at variables, you know, and how they impact a client's, let's say it's a financial plan or something. Mm-hmm. I think the technology will allow much better information, just like, you know, just like software, you know, and financial planning software is a lot better today than it was before because mm-hmm. you get better information and you can include more variables. I think AI just takes that a step further.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but as you and I talked before we were recording this, but I don't think they'll ever replace the human connection that comes mm-hmm. from, you know, from being a face-to-face, you know, face-to-face advisor.
Yeah. Generative AI cannot replace trust at this point.
No.
Right?
It's, no.
And it is such a trusted relationship.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people, just generative AI is kind of like, you're still like trusting, you know, the results of a Google search. Mm-hmm. It's like not all of it is real. A generative AI just gets the information a lot faster.
Yeah. Yeah. It just aggregates what's
that's
out
right.
there.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, I think that's it for today, Greg.
Right on.
Put you on the hot seat here a couple times.
Okay.
But welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back and look forward to more of these. What are we going to talk about next time? We'll think about that.
Yeah, I don't know. Don't put me on the spot like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, sorry about that.
We'll figure that out.
Yeah, we will.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Free Lunch Podcast hosted by Canvas Wealth. To subscribe to this podcast to get more realistic insights on investing or to connect with one of our talented partners, please head on over to canvaswealth.ca. We'll see you next time on the Free Lunch Podcast.
Financial planning services are offered through Canvas Wealth. Portfolio management services are provided by Q Wealth Partners, a registered portfolio manager, investment fund manager, and exempt market dealer. Canvas Wealth is an owner and partner in the Q Wealth Partnership. The information discussed in this show, including any opinion, is based on various sources believed to be reliable, but its accuracy cannot be guaranteed and is subject to change. The opinions expressed in this show are opinions of the individuals and do not represent the opinion of Q Wealth as a firm.